Just a murder of a problem. Go round and round and round. You know that God commanded Abraham to sacrifice his son Isaac. That's also a problem. The way it's easily put is, God is commanding Abraham to commit murder. Now, how do we deal with that? How do we relate to that? Isn't God supposed to be good, just, merciful, morally perfect? Here's God commanding Abraham to commit one of the greatest crimes, one of the greatest immoralities, murder. Now, as I have told some of you, there are people who think they have an easy way out. The easy way out that they propose is this: in the end, he doesn't kill him. Why doesn't he kill him? Because God tells him not to kill him. So they propose, the whole point of this story is to teach you that human sacrifice is wrong. That's the whole point of the story. Think when the story was written, Delta. It was at a time when human sacrifice was practiced all over the world. This was a gigantic step forward, a big step up in morality and civilization. The people should no longer kill their children for the gods. And here the Torah, Judaism, takes a step beyond all of its contemporaries. This explanation is absolute nonsense. This explanation is absolute nonsense. For two reasons. The smaller reason is that Abraham comes out, according to this explanation, to be a moral primitive, a savage. Abraham is prepared to kill his son. Yeah, no, that's ridiculous. Perhaps I'll leave the door open and talk him off. Abraham, according to this explanation, comes out to be a moral primitive, a savage. And the Torah has to tell him, Abraham, stop being a barbarian. Become civilized. Which is ridiculous. It's ridiculous as part of a book. The book does not paint any of our patriarchs and savages. That's a minor reason. The major reason is that it says in the story itself, right in the text, when the angel tells Abraham not to kill his son, he says, do not kill your son, because now I know that you are a God-fearing man, because you have not withheld your son, your only one, from me. You didn't withhold him. What does that mean? You did not withhold. You didn't hold him back. It means when I told you to kill him, you were ready to kill him. So you passed the test. Now that I see that you're ready to kill him, you passed the test. Not that one. Being ready to kill him is enough. You don't actually have to kill him. So the Torah is saying, when I tell you to kill your son, then you have to kill him. Abraham gets his praise, and he repeats on the next, about 4 verses later, God gives him a tremendous blessing because he didn't withhold the son. So the book is telling you, when God commands you to kill your son, you have to kill your son. That's what the book is telling you. Of course, these people who offer the explanation don't care about what the book says. They're called Reformed. I was brought up Reformed. This is how it was taught to me in Sunday school. But then the book is irrelevant. What's good is propaganda. But that the point of the story is to teach you that human sacrifice is absolutely wrong, unthinkable, savage, barbarian, primitive. And it teaches you by having the hero, Abraham, be brought through the whole story up to the end, and then from the heavens they tell him, no, that's not what we want. That's wrong. It's evil. It's terrible. That's the point of the story. Whereas the actual text says, I give you a blessing because you are ready to kill him. So it's just not right. What they're saying is not right. I leave you with a moral problem. Good. So we'll have to face it. I'm not going to blink it away, but to pretend that the story is something else, he's actually leading the Odyssey. It has nothing to do with us. Okay, now, there are a few other questions about the story, which I want to get to tonight. I hope I'll get to them. The story starts with the words, and after these things, God tested Abraham. God tested Abraham. How old was Isaac when this took place?
37.
I think if I were writing the story, just to say God tested Abraham, if I were writing the story, I would have the introductory sentence, I would write, and God tested Abraham and Isaac.
Yeah.
I mean, he's just got to die, that's all. He's 37. If he doesn't want to do this, he can get out of it, right? He can run away. But no. At a certain point, he's told that's what's going to happen, and he goes on there. Then, it says, now I know that you are a God-fearing man. Fear, awe. I wouldn't say there's anything particularly wrong with that description, but I could think of many other possible descriptions. I could say, now I know that you love God, now that I know you're self-sacrificing, now I know you're courageous, now I know you're obedient. There must be some reason why that particular description is chosen. Because you're prepared to do this, I know that you're God-fearing. Another question which we should address is what a follow-up what I mentioned a few minutes ago. Namely, human sacrifice was very common in the ancient world. Why is Abraham held up as doing something so special? Abraham's test is considered to be one of the highlights of all religious human history. It's in the Siddur. Many people read it every morning. It's just something which went on for centuries. All over the world. How many thousands and thousands of people were sacrificed? I suppose maybe some of them went kicking and screaming to the end, but some of them probably went willingly and were sacrificed willingly. Why is Abraham held up as doing something so unique and so outstanding? That's four questions, and there's a fifth one, but I can't ask it yet because you don't have enough information. And I'll start to work on the story in general, and we'll work on these questions, and then we'll come to the fifth question at the end of the
intercession. You
can
stone sacrifice?
Sorry?
The Incas in South America.
Do they really? I understood it stopped about 1,000 years ago. No, in Russia they did it until the 8th century. And it was, not so long ago. Those times. I don't know if they still do. Anyway. Let's do a little background on this question of murder. God's in control of the world. That's our view. God's running the world. Whatever happens, let's leave out free will. Maybe free will is different, but everything else other than free will is God's activity. The weather and the laws of nature, so-called, the tides, whatever it is, it's God's doing. That includes death. People die when God decides that they should die. Again, leaving out free will. I'm not talking about murder now. Let's forget that. That's a separate issue. We talked about it on another occasion. But let's take sickness. Let's take accident. Natural disasters. God is responsible for the deaths of almost all of mankind. Now let's ask a radical question. Why don't we call God a murderer? After all, if Peter stops Paul's life, we call Peter a murderer. Peter murdered Paul because he ended his life. God is stopping almost everybody's life. And ending almost everybody's lives. And so why wouldn't you call God a murderer?
Maybe we should. I don't know what your opinion is, but yeah.
Because he does it for the sake of good.
He does it for the sake of good. You should put it that way. I think maybe in the far distant sense you're right. But let's think about euthanasia. People claim that doing it for the person's good. Still, there's a big debate. There's a big debate whether that's appropriate or not. So,
but God would have to be able to decide whether or not that person would be ready to die, not a human.
Is that the only argument against euthanasia? That the person might be making a mistake? Yeah. Okay. Let's go back. Why would we not say that God is a murderer? Wouldn't it be relevant that God is the one who gives life? God is the one who gives life. Listen carefully. I don't say God gave life. I say God gives life. Here's the difference. If I give you a gift, I give it to you, so that it's yours. If I decide 6 months later I want it back, I can't take it back. A gift means that the ownership transfers. It's yours now. But let's suppose I'm giving you all the time. You have trouble with paying your electricity bills. So I said, listen, I'll hook up a wire, and you can take from me. I'll extend my electricity to your house, and I'll pay the bills. You're very thankful. If you'll have to buy a house in Israel, you'll find that the developing neighborhood is goes on all the time, because they're very irregular as to when they fix up the electricity, and very often the building's ready to move in, but all the city says, they're building from the building next door. So now, I'm providing you with your electricity. And then, you know, after a couple of months, I say, well, you know, I'm turning it off. Am I trampling on your rights? Am I victimizing you? I'm just stopping my free gift. I was giving you a free gift, and now I'm not giving you any more free gift. You have no claim on my gift. You have no right to my gift. I'm not being unjust to you if I say, I gave you 2 months of free electricity, I don't want to give you any more. That's all. Use candles. It's not up to me anymore. Life is like electricity. You have to be given life moment by moment. You don't have life on your own. You're like an appliance plugged into the wall. You have no batteries. So if the central generator shuts down, you're off. Now God is feeding us life moment by moment. At a certain point, he says, from my point of view, it's over. We didn't have any right to the life we enjoy. So, we certainly have no complaints if it ends. What kind of complaints do we have? A murderer is someone who takes away my life. Murder is, in a sense, like stealing. It's taking away something that's mine. Well, it certainly isn't his. My life isn't his. He's not providing it. So we can plausibly say he has no right to stop it. But God was giving it. How could one accuse God of a crime when he says, I've been giving you free life, something you didn't earn, you didn't deserve, I gave it to you for nothing, and that's all I'm giving you. I'm not giving you any more. What complaint could you have to God when he decides that that's all he's giving you? And even if someone says this, I'll take your word. Even if you'll tell me that with that life, you did everything that God wants. You lived a life of mitzvos. You did everything that God commanded to do. That would be like when I give you free electricity, and I want to turn it off, and you say, listen, you can't turn it off. Why not? Because you know what I used the electricity for? To write emails on behalf of Greenpeace, because I know you're interested in the environment, and to create fertilizers that won't pollute the atmosphere. I was doing everything that you like with the electricity. Does that mean I can't turn it off? Because you the electricity I gave you free in a way that I would approve of, therefore I can't turn it off. One thing has nothing to do with the other. No matter how good a life you live, that would only justify the gift of life you already got. It wouldn't give you a claim on more life. So when a person dies, what we call naturally, and what we understand, means that God has decided that he should die. We understand that God is well within his rights to decide when someone shall die, because it just means that God is not giving out any more free life. That's point number one. Yes, the question.
Well, it might sound a bit free, but if you leave the afterlife aside, the time,
yes,
and you use your analogy that you're going for that electricity, going for the next to neighbor's house, and feeding them, supplying them electricity, I would say that God's place in our life is not as a next door neighbor giving us electricity, but more as, you know, a father or a parent figure who's responsible for us. So then you might say that by him withdrawing from life, he's in effect being neglectful.
Okay, now we'll come back to what he said. So this is his answer, as far down the line. This is as far down the line. Right? That far ahead. Right? Now the claim is not murder. Now the claim is not murder anymore, but it's neglect. Now his answer will be that when it happens only for the good. But murder you see is something else. If someone says, if A says, I'm going to kill B because it's for B's good, and B doesn't agree, we don't usually allow A that prerogative, even if A is right. Even if A is right, then it's for his good. Even if later B will say, I wish you had killed me, doesn't matter. You can't kill another person against his will. And here, most people, they ask them, do you want to go? The answer will be, no, I don't want to go. So the primary claim when people die is that God is a murderer, that he's killing them. Right? That claim has been answered. Now, let's go to Abraham. So now, how do people die? People die of heart attacks, and they die of diseases, and they die of accidents. God is saying to Abraham, Isaac's time is up. That's all I want him to live. 3 days from now, and I don't want him to live anymore. And this is how I want him to go. I could have him bitten by a snake. I could have him fall off a cliff. I could have him die of indigestion. Swallow his tongue in his sleep. There are a lot of ways for people to die. I want him to die in sacrifice. Here, it will not be murder. Now we see what was wrong with the question in the first place. The question was, how can God command murder? The simple answer is, when God commands it, it's not murder. By definition, when God commands it, it's not murder. Because it is within God's moral prerogative to determine when a person shall die. And therefore, if God commands it, it's not murder. So this is the answer to the question, where is the morality? In the act? Because when God commands it, it's not murder. I want you to know, the Midrash is fabulous. It's fabulous here. The Midrash reports Abraham, when it's all over, saying to God, you know, when you commanded me to kill my son, I had an objection. I had a very good objection. My objection would have been this. You yourself told me that Isaac is going to be your continuation. Isaac will be your future. Your future generations will come out of Isaac. And now you're telling me to kill him before he's had any children. So you contradicted yourself. And I could very well have thrown up that contradiction to you. But I didn't. I didn't. I listened and I was prepared to obey. So, says Abraham, in the future, when my children perform averos, crimes, sins, and you have an objection against it, you have a really good objection against it, don't use it. Just like I didn't use my objection against you, don't you use your objection against them. Now what's fascinating about this midrash is that it records Abraham expressing an objection. Well, what is the objection? You contradicted yourself. The objection is not, you're commanding murder, and murder is immoral. That objection isn't expressed. Obviously, the magistrate didn't see that as an objection. What it saw as an objection is the guy's contradicting himself, but not that he's commanding murder. Now I've given you an explanation as to why that is. Now let's go back to the questions that we raised about the story. Why does it say that God tested Abraham and doesn't say that he tested Isaac? Now, some of you may know that Abraham and Isaac had certain themes to their lives. Each of them had a theme to his life. Abraham's theme was chesed, loving kindness. Isaac's theme was strict justice. Some of this is in the Chumash itself, and a great deal of it is in the Midrash, and certainly in the Kabbalistic writings. These are the themes they lived by. Let's look at the test through the lenses of each one's theme, and see what this test means, and then we'll understand why the chapter starts the way it does. Let's start with Isaac. Isaac is strict justice. Strict justice means I only want what I've earned. I only want what's mine by right. I only want that to which I have a just claim. Well, does anyone have a right to life against God? You owe me life? You have to give me life? Obviously not. Given what I've explained to you, no one has a right to life against God. God doesn't owe anybody anything in particular. He doesn't owe life. So if Isaac says, I only want what's mine by right, God can say to him that I want you to die for me. By your own principle, you should be prepared to do this. By your own principle, you should be prepared to do this. This is simply an application of the principle you stand for. Now, I don't want to be misunderstood. I don't mean that, therefore, that's easy. Living by your principles is often difficult. But it's the difficulty of living up to your principles. That was the test from Isaac's point of view. What I'm telling you now is in an essay for Tesla. Abraham is loving kindness. Abraham expresses loving kindness so much that the society of Sodom, who had a philosophy of anti-chesed, Sodom stood for the opposite of Abraham. When God tells Abraham that God is going to destroy Sodom, Abraham has all sorts of arguments against. No, you can't do it, but the righteous can't kill, and even the wicked you should forgive. Maybe there are 50 there, and the 50 should get forgiveness for the whole place. Abraham is so consistent in his expression of loving kindness, he doesn't even want to see our criminals die. No, and now God tells Abraham, kill your own son, who isn't a citizen of Sodom, who is a great child, and it's the one whom he loves, naturally. So God is constructing a test for Abraham that contradicts everything he stands for. It contradicts the theme of his life. It contradicts his identity. Even, and this is the Midrash now, even God contradicts himself in his instructions to Abraham. So that Abraham at this point has nothing to hold on to. He has nothing to hold on to, almost nothing. We'll see whether there's something later, but that's what I've given you so far. He can't even hold on to the fact that God has a plan and God is pushing him through the stages of the plan, even though it's difficult. Because at this point, if God contradicts himself, he hasn't a clue what the plan really is. This is why the Torah starts with the words, God tested Abraham. Because the Torah wants to make prominent the uniqueness of Abraham's test. Everyone in life is tested to live up to his principles. Some of you will be lawyers. Oh, will you be tested? Every lawyer has hundreds of opportunities to cheat. And will have dozens of opportunities where people will tell him to cheat. And he'll lose cases because he's not prepared to cheat. My father, Oliver Sloan, worked in insurance. And the regularity of suggestions, and he never took a kickback or a bribe of any kind. He just refused to do. And he lost any number of cases because he wasn't prepared to do. He wouldn't give a kickback. It's on his commissions. So everyone is tested to live up to his principles. But it is not so common that a person is tested to do something that violates his principles. And he has to do it anyway. That's a much more severe test. And this is what the Torah wants to make proper. This also is the answer to the question, why is Abraham so special? If child sacrifice was so widely practiced in the ancient world, why is he so special? The answer is this. Human sacrifice in the ancient world was economic. It was paying a lesser evil to avoid a larger evil. Why would you sacrifice a person to the gods? Because if you don't, there won't be rain. And if there's no rain, then a lot of people will die. And dying of thirst is not a pretty way to go. So, you sacrifice one in order to save the many. And if that sounds primitive to you, or superstitious to you, or barbarian to you, let me remind you that almost every modern society has an institution which is dedicated to precisely that principle. Sacrifice the lives of the few so as to protect the many. What institution is that? The army. You put people in the army and you send them out to die so as to protect the rest of the society. And you have the lifeboat cases. The ship goes down, the lifeboat is overcrowded. If they all stay in, it's going to swamp it every moment of ground. So what do? They cast lots and throw a few people overboard. This is modern, moral, conscientious, civilized people. Sacrificing the few to save the many is not primitive at all. Only we don't believe you can affect the weather that way. We differ with them in their science, not in their morality. So, their sacrifice was economic. Abraham's sacrifice was the opposite of economics. There is nothing that you could have offered Abraham. There is nothing with which you could have threatened him to get him to sacrifice his son voluntarily. Abraham, if you sacrifice his son, he'll have 1 billion ounces of gold. Can you imagine that moving Abraham? I don't think so. Abraham, if you don't sacrifice your son, I'm going to boil you in oil. Where's the pot? That's all he wants to know. I'll jump in. There's nothing you could bribe Abraham with or threaten him with to get him to want to sacrifice his son. So the test of Abraham has, on the one hand, and the human sacrifice in the ancient world are poles apart. They have no relationship to one another whatsoever. Now we can raise the fifth question. If this test really does contradict everything Abraham stands for, his loving kindness, and his understanding of what God wants of him and wants of the world, plans for history. If he contradicts everything he stands for, how does he do it? Where within him comes the response to do it? Where does it come from? You know, if a person does something, it's got to link up with his motivation somewhere. It's got to mean something to him. Something in him has to say yes. Okay, we could use the modern Saturday jargon. It's got to resonate. Right? It's got to resonate. Just slaughtering the light. Where in Abraham do you have any principle, any motivation, any meaning that responds positively? This is what the Torah records when it says, now I know that you stand in awe of God. Standing in awe of God means recognizing that God is incomparably greater. Incomparably greater. So Abraham's attitude at this point is as follows. God has told me to do something which I don't understand at all. It contradicts everything I stand for, and he even contradicted himself in telling me to do it. I can't see any meaning in this. Now, when one says, I can't see any meaning in this, is that a comment about this or a comment about I? That depends upon whether you're American or not American. If you're American and you say, I can't see any meaning in this, it's a comment about this. This is backup. But if you're not American, you might reflect, if I can't see any meaning in it, maybe it's my failure. Maybe there is a meaning that I can't see. Maybe it's my inability to see that's in question. And that's what Yirei Elohim means. Yirei Elohim means God is so incomparably greater than I, that even when to me it is a clear, manifest contradiction, still, I trust that there is a meaning to it. It's just that I'm not getting it. Not, I don't see a meaning, so therefore there is no meaning. So therefore it is absurd. Like Kierkegaard and other Christian theologians did it. That's a Christian approach. But rather, I don't see meaning in it, so I'm lacking. My vision is short-sighted. But there is a meaning. I trust there's a meaning because God has great enough for him to have meaning for it. It needs a meaning that I can't see. And that's how he did it. That's what carried him through. The attitude here is one that's similar. I've mentioned this to some of you on other occasions. When you are dealing with an idea that's very strange, very paradoxical, and you don't know what to make of it. It doesn't compute. You know, it just doesn't go into your head because it's just very weird. What do you do when you come across an idea like that? The first thing you do is ask who's saying it. What are his credentials? And if the person's credentials are good enough, then you may say, well, it certainly doesn't make sense to me. But he said so. No, if he said so, there's probably some sense in it that I don't appreciate. And this could be in any level. I remember a doctor, I think it was in Boston, named Paul Gutley White. He said, a person has a heart attack, a lot of fun, what does he do? After the heart attack is exercise. Exercise regularly. Now, there were a lot of people to whom that made no sense at all. Listen, doc, the heart is a muscle. A heart attack needs a hustle. The muscle is damaged. You have a damaged muscle. Damaged, doctor, damaged. And now you want to exercise, so you use the damaged muscle. What's that going to do? It's going to damage it more. And super, super smart. ABCs, any 7-year-old can see that. How can you say something so stupid, doctor? It's just that his patients did better than other patients. With his regimen of exercise, they had a much longer survival time. That was against intuition. Really was against intuition. So what? Turned out to be right. And if I tell you that there are two infinities, one bigger than the other. You didn't hear the explanation from me, some of you did. You didn't hear the explanation, that should sound very peculiar. Because infinity goes on forever. No, are there two forevers, one further away? What does it mean? There are two infinities, one's bigger than the other. Everybody in the world thought that that was nonsense until the 1880s, when a fellow named Georg Cantor, who happened to be Jewish, invented transfinite mathematics. His symbol for infinity is the aleph. To this day, books on this subject are filled with alephs. Hebrew alephs. He created definitions and theorems in which he demonstrated that there are different size infinities. So now, I happen to have a PhD in mathematical logic. I used to teach this sort of thing. So I'm wearing my PhD hat, and I tell you this. The appropriate thing to you to say is, well, it sure sounds crazy to me, two different size infinities, but this guy has a PhD in the subject, and he taught it there, textbooks in the subject. So probably it makes sense, and I just don't get it. Richard Feynman writes about cases where cause and an effect, that the effect comes first. The effect happens before the cause. Now, I tell you, that's when my mind goes on holiday. The effect has happened, but the thing that makes it happen hasn't happened yet. That's going to happen later. To me, that's just, you know, off the track. That's over the red line. I can't make my peace with that. But so what? Richard Feynman had a Nobel Prize in physics. He wasn't dumb. He might have even been a little smarter than I am. And if so, it probably makes sense, even if I don't get it. So we are confronted with this sort of thing. People who get an education are confronted with this sort of thing all the time. As a proposition which is very peculiar. It doesn't make sense to me, but it comes from authority who clearly is worthy of trust. And we don't throw it out. Now, Abraham is in exactly the same situation. Here, I think it's very important to remember that Abraham's test of sacrificing his son happened at the end of a long career. Let's think back. Abraham and Sarah are living in Haran, and they have no children. They're accustomed to them in Haran. For decades they have no children. God says, go to the land of Canaan, you'll have children. So they go to the land of Canaan, and they don't have children. But they go down to Egypt. Pharaoh takes Abraham's wife. There's a plague on the house of Pharaoh, and Pharaoh sends him out with riches. Now listen, this is a public event. This is a public event. This happened in the palace of Pharaoh, the head of the Egyptian Empire. This isn't a dream that Abraham had. Then he comes back, and his cousin is abducted in a war. And in one night, he defeats the consortium of four kings' armies and frees his nephew. This is a public event. He fought a battle and defeated an army. Then God says to Abraham that Sodom and Gomorrah have been destroyed. He argues and pleads on their behalf. The next day, he goes over to the cliff and he can see a smoldering ruin. The ruin of Sodom is a public event. Everybody can see it. Then, years later, Abraham and Sarah do have a child. He's 100, she's 99. Both are past childbearing age, and they have a child anyway. So these are public events. No one can deny them. And they are all miraculous. And they are part of this relationship that Abraham has with this voice that tells him what to do and what's going to happen. This helps to answer, though others answer differently, the Rambam answers differently in the Mora, but for our generation, I think this is the way to answer it. Why did Abraham trust the voice that told him to sacrifice his son? Why didn't he think he was hallucinating? Because he's had experience with this voice. This voice has been connected with spectacular public events. It's impossible to regard this as a kind of an inner problem, you know, some kind of psychological problem. Because it has outer effects that are public, that everybody can see. So now, Abraham reflects on the past, and he says, listen, God is clearly much more powerful than I am, more powerful than any force of which we know. And God has promised me things, protected me, made me successful, given me children. See, obviously he's committed to me, and now he tells me to do this. And this I can't understand. This I really cannot understand. So after 60 plus years of consistent relationship with God, Abraham says that this too must be good. It must be right. Though I can't imagine that. I can't imagine that. My analogy is this. I don't know if you've heard of Albert Schweitzer. He was a very outstanding, I'd say that he's a caring person. He was a doctor. And he went to some place in Africa and spent years there treating the natives. Now let's imagine, the Schweitzer is there for a couple of years, and he uses antibiotics on their infections, and he sets their broken bones, and he delivers their babies, and generally gives them the benefits of Western medicine. After 2 years, a native comes in and has a terrible problem with his foot. It's turned a different color, and it's very painful. And Schweitzer says, I'm sorry, we have to amputate your foot. It's gangrene. Of course, the natives don't know what gangrene is, but Schweitzer knows. Now, let's imagine the native thinking this through. I don't get it. This guy's been here 2 years. And every time when a person had a problem, he solved the problem and the person walked away healthy. Healthy, functioning. Now he wants to cut off my foot. What happened to him? You know, been drinking too much, you know, or just it turned vicious, or who knows what's going on with me. Could the natives make an argument to trust Schweitzer? Is it possible for them to argue, to think it through, and justify trusting Schweitzer? Of course it is. It's Edison. He obviously knows much more about Edison than we do. Number two, he's spending 2 years, 3 years in this backwards area. He could be in a penthouse in Manhattan, but he isn't. He's over here. He must care about us. And he says the foot has to be amputated, then presumably it has to be amputated. So he's never done anything like this before, but he's done enough to give himself credibility. So here Abraham says, I've had 60 years of interaction with God. 60 years. And in every case, he has proven his superior knowledge, his superior power, and his commitment to me. And now he tells me to do this. There's got to be something right in it. There's got to be something good in it, even though I can't appreciate it, can't understand. I don't think we should ever use the word faith. I think the word faith is a Christian word. In place of faith, wherever you would want to say faith, I would recommend you use a different phrase. I recommend you say rational trust. Rational trust. What does trust mean? Trust means I don't know it for myself. I don't know it for myself. I'm trusting somebody else. But it can be reasonable to trust somebody else. He can have earned my trust. Some people earn your trust. Some people have credibility. And then you rely on them. Rational trust. That's what the Torah requires of a person. To recognize that God has earned credibility, and then when he tells you to do something, to trust that there is some right idea behind it, even though, at the moment anyway, you may very well not understand what it is. This was Abraham's test. Faith in English, faith really is a word, as I say, rooted in Christianity. Faith usually means accepting something which is either against reason or beyond reason, that reason does not certify as correct. The whole point of faith is to go beyond reason. La coeur est sans raison, they say in French. The heart has its reasons, meaning the heart knows. I can't tell you any. That's all right. The heart knows. The heart itself can feel that it's right. In certain strains of Christianity, the intellect is the enemy. The intellect is an agent of the subtle. The intellect is trying to drag you down. But the intellect wants reasons. And you have to appreciate it beyond reason. I mentioned Kierkegaard before. Kierkegaard learns from the story of Abraham that you have to do it when it's absurd because it's absurd. Kierkegaard understands that there's a contradiction here, but he says that Abraham glories in the contradiction. He rejoices in the contradiction. Because since it's a contradiction, it shows that it's beyond me, and I rejoice in it because it has no explanation at all. The absurd for the sake of the absurd. Right? That's a Christian approach. That's not a Jewish approach, not the Torah's approach. Torah's approach is, it's beyond me, but that just means that the reason in it is beyond me. Just like a neophyte in mathematics will say, they tell me there are two different infinities. Well, it doesn't make sense to me, but it surely makes sense. Just it doesn't make sense to me. Yeah.
Rational trust, is that
the
correct translation of the word
emunah? Oh, look at that. You're both the same question. Well, emunah in the Tanakh, in the Bible, doesn't have anything to do with belief. It's never used in the sense of belief. Where is the first time that the word emunah is used in the Torah? Does anybody know? You have blue books here, I'll show it to you. It's at the end of the cell. On page 393. Yeah, it's not a very common word in the question. The Jews have left Egypt, and the Moloch comes to attack them. This is before Sinai. A Moloch comes to attack them. So Moses says to Joshua, make an army and go out and do battle with the Moloch. And they did it. And Moses climbed up on a hill and he raised his hand. When he raised his hand, the Jews were winning. When he lowered his hand, the Moloch was winning. His hands grew heavy So Aaron and Hur, who were with him, took a stone, put it under him, and he sat on it. Aaron and Hur supported his hands, one on this side, one on that side. And it says, his hands, I'm giving the little translation, his hands were emunah until the sun went down. His hands were emunah. Now what heaven's name does that mean? His hands were emunah. Does that mean his hands were faith? Does it mean his hands believed? It means his hands were faithful. They carried out their job without flagging. They carried out their job faithfully.
Wait a minute. So monotheism is the concept of the middle meaning place.
It has been taken over, and I can explain that. I'm just point out, in biblical Hebrew, it's always the Hamin Bila. Never the Hamin Shed. Hamin Shed is a rabbinic creation. Hamin Shed might mean, I believe that. But when after belief comes the particle that, in biblical Hebrew it never has a that, never has a shed. It's always good. That really means I trust in something. I trust him. Amin Bashem means to trust him. To live faithfully to him. To be faithful to him. It's not an intellectual matter of belief. It's carrying out your relationship to him in the way you live and trusting. That's really what emunah means. It's not easy to do that. Anyway, so faith, as I said, means to be something which is either anti-reason or beyond reason, not something that's certified by reason. For us, it's always certified by reason. What may be certified by reason is that you should trust. Trust means going beyond what you personally know. But it is often rational to go beyond what you personally know. And that's what Abraham was attested to do. That's the test that he passed. And that's why I think it's in the Siddur, and many people say it every day, because although it is a minority at the time, everyone at one time or another either himself undergoes such a test, or is aware of others who undergo such a test, where you don't see the reason. You don't clearly see the reason for what's going on. And then you have to reenact the test of Abraham, except for one thing, that Abraham did it first. It's infinitely easier to be second. Abraham did it first. And this helps to explain also when the passage starts, God says to Abraham, Kach noh es bencho, please take your son. And of course the commentators all wonder, well, God tells to say to Abraham, please? He's asking for a favor. So the commentators say, yes, yes. Here's what God said to Abraham. This is test number 10. I want you to pass one more test, because I'm afraid that people will say the first 9 tests were nothing. Therefore, I want you to stand for me in this 10th test. Now, some of you have been studying Talmud, you know, you're learning to think. That's what you come to Yeshiva for, to learn to think. Listen to the proposition. Stand for me in this test, because I'm afraid that people will say the first 9 were nothing. So if he succeeds in this test, what is it supposed to teach me? That the first 9 were something. It's not enough that he passed the 10th test and it'd be spectacular. Because that won't contradict the proposition we're worried about, that the first 9 were nothing. No, it's got to be spectacular, and it's got to teach you something about the first 9 also. So here's one way to explain it. If you look at the first 9 tests, all of them were based on principles that Abraham understood. He has stood them and he identified them. What was he asked to do? To sacrifice for his principles. For his principles. Leave Haran. Why? Because over there I'll make you into a great nation. That's not a bad proposition. That's not a bad proposition. Over here you're going to be nothing, and over there you're going to be something. Okay, traveling at the age of 75 is not simple. Correct, it's difficult. But it's for a purpose that you understand. What you can appreciate. So people will say, what is Abraham? Abraham is a noble person who's prepared to sacrifice for his principles. No one will be able to see that what Abraham is doing is essentially serving God. rather than just sacrificing for his own prison. So God says, I'm going to put you through one more test. And in this test, there'll be no ambiguity. There'll be no ambiguity. I'll understand the kind of person that you are. And the fact that before what I told you to do was consistent with your principles is not the reason why you did it. May have made it easier, but that's not the reason why you did it. Everything you do because you're serving me. I know that, but they don't know that. And that's why this is the time when Abraham's era is awe of God is made known. Before that, you don't see his awe of God. What you see is his love of God.
Yes,
because I stand for certain things, and God stands for the same things, and he puts a stamp of approval on what I stand for, and says, yes, this is good. Terrific. Terrific. So then Abraham says, he and I, we're in tune with one another. We're in sync with one another. He's reinforcing what I am. That's the way it looks from the outside. So God says, I want one test where people will not be able to say that. So appreciate what you really are. And that was his test. And every one of us has that challenge to some extent, some larger, some smaller. We know of others. We live in the post-Holocaust era at this challenge. And at a certain point, we have to take Abraham's stance. It's hard for us to see what the reason is. It's got to these principles that we know of, but it has to be. It has to be. The Ramban has a beautiful, beautiful explanation of the book of Job. I don't know if you'll ever read the book of Job. Job is suffering, and his three friends come and comfort him. But the line the three friends take is basically, if God is punishing you, then you did something wrong. It's got to be, because God is just, and God doesn't make mistakes. So if God is punishing you, you must have done something wrong. Job says, I know that I didn't do anything wrong. I know it. And they said, well, you've got to be wrong. Now, they didn't have any reason to say that, except they said, we know that God is just. So if God is just and you're suffering, it must be that you did something wrong. So God chastises them, criticizes them, rejects them. Says to Ramban, what should they have said? They should have said, Job is innocent, because he knows he's innocent, and he's not lying, and he's not making a mistake, he's innocent. And God is just. He wouldn't punish unless Job was guilty. They're both true. And they contradict one another. So the solution has to lie somewhere in some principle of the Torah of which we're in. To accept the contradiction. Because both sides have a good justification to be true. And to confess your inability to solve it. And to say the solution must lie. There is a solution. I can't solve it, but there is a solution. And the solution lies in an aspect of the Torah that hasn't been revealed to us. That's the Jewish answer. Not Kierkegaard or Hausdorff. The Jewish answer is not to blink away the contradiction, not to pretend it isn't a contradiction. Be honest. The logic says, if he says he's innocent, he's innocent. And the logic says that God wouldn't punish unless he's guilty, so he must be guilty. That's what logic says. That's a contradiction? Yes, that's a contradiction. What do I do now? I say, not. I embrace the absurd because it shows it transcends mankind. No, it's not absurd. I just don't see the way out. I don't see the way out. So what? That's just me. There must be a principle of the Torah that solves it. That's Jewish logic. What's the principle, by the way, that solves it? We spoke about it the other night. The incarnation. The incarnation. This isn't your only life. But that was beyond their scope. That was beyond their horizon. That just didn't occur to them. The minute you say reincarnation, the problem dissolves. You didn't see the whole of his life. When you say he's innocent, you mean he's innocent in this stretch of life. But you didn't see the rest of his life. So, of course, you can't know about that, whether it's innocent over there or not. Just means you have to widen your eyes, but that didn't occur to them. But because it didn't occur to them, and because they were small-minded, they said, if you're being punished and God is just, you must be guilty. And if you say you're innocent, you're lying. You're self-deceived. instead of facing the contradiction as a contradiction, preserving it as a contradiction, and recognizing that the solution has to come from outside the frame of reference. Somewhere outside the frame of reference is a broader perspective from which the solution comes. Okay, this is says Mr. Arik Mula in this commentary. And you have... Okay.